That's the end of the first half. As the teams head to the locker room, the Spartans lead the Bulldogs by a score.
You guys stink.
Jeez, Coach, we're only down a couple of points.
No, I mean you guys really smell. You need to hit the showers. And here, I got every one of you new bars of soap from the Sterling Soap Company. Each bar is artisan crafted using natural ingredients and essential oils. They also have shave soaps, colognes, beard balm, and a whole lot more. Now get in there.
But Coach, we have another half to play.
I don't care. I can't stand to be around you.
A few minutes later.
All right, bring it in tight. You guys are still playing terrible, but you're smelling great out there. Now listen, you're going to need to stock up for the rest of the season. We got a lot of tough games left. So go to sterlingsoap.com after the game. That's S-T-I-R-L-I-N-G soap.com. You got that?
Yes, Coach.
Great. sterlingsoap.com on three. One, two, three.
sterlingsoap.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hello, old sports, and welcome to the Hello, Old Sports podcast on the Sports History Network. Why don't we're going to do things a little bit differently here, and I'm going to start right off with Andrew. How are you doing tonight?
Dan, I'm doing well. It's freezing cold, and we got about 15 inches of snow here in Connecticut over the weekend. But we're dug out, and we're back to work.
Well, I'm jealous of the fact that you're dug out, because we in Maryland are emphatically not dug out yet. And our neighbor told us that the our neighbor told us yesterday that our town uses the solar powered method of snow plowing. And it took me a minute to figure out what he was talking about. Then I realized that what they mean is they don't plow the street and they just wait for the sun to melt the snow. So we're still kind of waiting on that here. But like you, and I think like much of the country, we're still digging out here. And that is sort of a pretty good segue, because it is wintertime. It is very much wintertime, and pretty much it'll be time for the 2026 version of the Winter Olympics. And we are pleased to have with us tonight an author, Doug Levy, who has written a book on both the summer and the Olympics. Both the summer and the Winter Olympics. The author is Doug Levy, and the book is Hero Redefined: Profiles of Olympic Athletes Under the Radar. And Doug, I want to thank you so much for joining us here tonight.
Thanks to both of you. It's an honor to be with you.
Well, thank you very much. We appreciate you saying that. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the book to start off? Because it's not, and I think you're very upfront about this in the intro. It's a very much sort of a different type of Olympic book. This is not a book where you're going to read about Michael Johnson and Jesse Owens and Nancy Kerrigan and sort of the big name medalists in American Olympics history, or really anywhere. So give us a little idea of what this book is about and what exactly you mean when you're talking about unsung heroes.
Absolutely. Well, it starts with the fact that I'm an unabashed lover of all things Olympics. In my book, in the introduction, I start off with a quote from the great basketball coach, ex-coach George Raveling, where he said, "It's the only time you can represent your country and not have to carry a gun." And so I love the Olympic Games when it's done well and done right as a gathering place for athletes all over the world. And they come with no guarantees whatsoever. They're there to represent their country and to do their very best, and nothing else is assured for them. And I love that. And so with summer and winter games both, I think it's an incredible spectacle. But the other driver for me to write this book is I've always been fascinated that in this country, we love to gravitate to the winners. And in the case of the Olympics, the winners and the medalists, really. And there's a lot of good reason for that. You mentioned, sprinters like Michael Johnson and Jesse Owens, and, you take a Simone Biles, a Michaela Schifrin. They're unbelievable athletes. The thing, though, is if you look beyond those winners, there's tremendous stories in the Olympic Games every time around. And what I tried to do is help people peel back the onion a few layers and understand that there's tremendous heroism that exists beyond the medal stand.
The Olympics, especially in the U.S., are so interesting because a lot of the sports that are, you know, what we think of as signature Olympic sports don't really get a lot of mainstream coverage outside of 2.5 weeks every 4 summers or every 4 winters. And suddenly everybody's an expert on figure skating or sprinting or water polo or whatever. So it's so interesting because while obviously there are communities within those sports that pay attention year round, year in and year out, you basically get a few chances at mainstream, I guess, success and or fame or just, you know, gratification or whatever. And it can be a long road back if something goes wrong, like some of these stories. You get hurt on the last lap, you find out sick, something like that.
I think that's absolutely right. And I've done interviews where I've reminded people that the Olympics is really, it's a crapshoot. It's every 4 years, and we have this concentrated period of a few weeks. And so when you think about it and think about some of these sports, as you talked about, Andrew, you have to have so many things go so well to get to a medal stand. And that may not be the case. You know, the example I give a lot is your track and field fan. You know, there was a distance runner named Mary Decker Slaney. You know, she's probably most infamous for having a South African runner named Zola Budd step on her foot and cost her a medal. But Mary Decker Slaney set 17 world records during her time as a middle and long distance runner. I would probably go into a bar with you guys and have a beer and argue she may be the greatest middle and long distance female runner we've ever seen, but she never won a gold medal. And so the thing is, you know, you're going to get some unbelievable performances, but you're also going to get heartbreak and fourth place and everything went wrong for me. And yet I did something else incredible. And those are the stories I was looking to harvest in my book.
So the heart of the book is I think it's 13 different athletes, or I guess it's athletes and a couple of other figures. Tell us a little bit about the types of people that you profiled and how you went about selecting those individuals.
Sure. Well, I wanted to focus on both summer and winter games. So I think you find almost an even split in the book, and I wanted to profile both male and female Olympians. And then, honestly, my bias was toward those who didn't win any kind of a medal. Now, there's two exceptions in the book. There's a track and field athlete named Manteo Mitchell, and then a 200-meter sprinter from Australia named Peter Norman. But if you read the book, you'll see that their stories and what I focus on in their chapters has much more to do with other things than medals. So I looked for mostly the non-medalists. I looked for a mix of winter and summer, a mix of male and female. And then, you know, the book categorizes the athletes within it. Either they showed unbelievable willpower to finish, or they came back from horrific setbacks, be those physical or psychological, or they showed sportsmanship that was on another level, or they did something in the area of human rights and equal rights that I found very heroic. So that's how I got to the athletes in the book.
How many of these people did you get the opportunity to interview? Because I know that at least one of the chapters focuses on your interactions with a gentleman from Tanzania, John Stephen, is it Akwilani? I think I might need your help.
Akwari.
Okay. So it sounds like at least some of these individuals you actually had the chance to speak with, meet, that type of thing.
So I interviewed every one of them. and sometimes on multiple occasions. And then I also took great pains to ask the athletes about interviewing their family members or their members of their inner circle, because I wanted to hear a variety of perspectives. So there's probably a couple of hundred interviews that went into the book. I will say, you know, thank you, Zoom technology, because, you know, through the beauty of Zoom, that's where I did most of the interviews. And as you said, Mr. Akwari from Tanzania was an in-person interview because my wife and I were already traveling to Tanzania and we managed to get help tracking him down. And so that was a lot of fun to interview him in person.
Well, Dan and I have talked about this more in the context of like books that are about, you know, a certain team or whatever. And it's like, you tend to get better interviews when it's not somebody who gets interviewed 10 million times. You know, I think we were talking about it in the context of a book somebody had written about the 1990s New York Knicks. And it's like, Patrick Ewing, even if he's, you know, friendly in a good interview, he's answering these questions that he's answered thousands of times.
Right.
If you're talking to a guy who was, you know, the 10th guy on the team for 2 years, he probably doesn't get interviewed all that much. And he might be a little more engaging and willing to, you know, to go into detail than a guy who's done it so many times over and over and over.
I think that's a great point, Andrew. And I found that, to a person, the athletes I interviewed, you know, they really gave their stories to me. They were candid. They trusted me to tell them well. And I'll be forever grateful because this was my first book. And, you know, frankly, I'm a nobody asking these guys to let me interview them and let me tell their story. And they all were willing to do that. And so I'll always see them as, you know, a bunch of my kids, if you will. I loved talking with all of them. And I hope that comes through in the book, that there's really rich stories with all of these athletes.
So I want to maybe drill down on some of these individual stories, but sure. Let me first ask you sort of really an unfair question. Okay. If you had to pick one, and maybe not even if you had to pick one, but maybe pick one, like give me a story that you think of a specific individual that you think maybe kind of really demonstrates what this book and this whole effort is about.
Oh boy, you're getting into sensitive territory, but I will tell you there are two athletes that were the drivers for me writing this book in the first place.
Okay.
So I'll answer it that way.
Perfect.
I love them all. But the female marathoner who was a major driver of this book for me, her name is Gabrielle Anderson Shias. She's alive and well and living in Sun Valley with her husband. And Gabrielle was part of the first ever women's marathon in 1984 in the LA Games. And it sounds silly to talk about 1984 being the first ever women's marathon. Now that we look back, we're like, well, of course there's a women's marathon. At that time, we were only about 10 or 15 years removed from all these barricades to women running in marathon, all these supposed doubts about their physical ability to do so. But she was part of that first marathon. Fans of track and field may remember that Joan Benoit, now Joan Benoit Samuelson, was the runaway winner of that marathon. But Gabrielle Anderson Shias suffered some major heat exhaustion, dehydration, really came stumbling into the Olympic Stadium in Los Angeles. And if you go online and Google Gabrielle Anderson Shias, you'll recognize the video of her lurching from side to side and really struggling to finish. And I don't want to spoil it for readers beyond that, but she was one of the people that I thought, oh my gosh, this is incredible. And the other is chapter one of the book is about a relay runner named Manteo Mitchell, a native of North Carolina, and he went to Western Carolina. And Manteo had the honor of leading off the men's 4x400 relay team semifinal in the London Games in 2012. And Manteo was he was out like a shot. He was running very, very well. And 200 meters into his 400 meter relay, he hears an audible snap. And he knows something is incredibly wrong. Remember, he's part of a four-man relay team. So he's got the next runner on a jumbotron motioning to him, and he's got to figure out what to do. And I remember reading about Manteo's story in Agatype, one of those things on page four of the sports section, right? You know, and thinking, geez, this is just incredible. So those two people were the drivers for the rest of the book. And I, you know, I began to research other athletes and what I found to be other, you know, incredible examples of quiet heroism and resourcefulness. And that's what led to the book. So those, I didn't answer your question directly, Dan, because that's a tough one for me to answer, but I did give you the two trendsetters, if you will.
And one of the things that I learned from this book is that distance running at the 1984 Olympics in Los Angeles was a very punishing experience, because two of the 13 that you profile, you talked about Gabriel Anderson and then also David Moorcroft from Great Britain, who I believe was in the 5,000 meter race, if I'm remembering correctly, had a similar, obviously the physical specifics were a little different, but had the same type of thing, struggling in the heat and the sun to finish a long distance race. So that was something that was interesting to me. There's so much, about the 84 Olympics, right? And Andrew and I did an episode a couple years ago, specifically on 1984 in sports. And, you know, the Olympics were obviously a big part of that, but the grueling nature of distance running in the 84 Olympics was something that stuck out to me.
If you think about it, it's the summer in Southern California. And some of this might be my Northeast bias, but the two marathons I think of the most in the U.S. are the Boston Marathon, which is in early April or mid-April when it's still cold, and the New York Marathon, which is like the second weekend in November when it's gotten cold again. So you're running in the Southern California heat, and you're doing it in the city that's notorious for smog in the decade. It's the most notorious for the worst smog. Like you really couldn't come up with a worse combination for people's, you know, these are the world-class athletes and they're struggling to make it through and breathe. So, you know.
Absolutely. And let's talk about two other biggies from 1984. Now that you guys have opened that a crack. First of all, LA is a miserably tough place to run in the heat of August. But the thing that happened in those Olympics and on that day in the marathon that doesn't typically happen in Los Angeles, you know, we think of, if you're going to name your high humidity locations across the United States, you know, you're going to toss out Miami and Atlanta and maybe Washington, D.C. and New Orleans, where you get that incredible 95, 98, 100 degree humidity. That's not typically Los Angeles, but that day it was for the marathon. It was 95% humidity. The second thing, and this is going to sound silly to everybody listening to this podcast now, but, you know, any of the three of us run a 10K today, we can expect 4, 5, 6 water stations, right? They're everywhere. That first women's marathon, there were 5, you guys. And for the men, too. So there were only 5 water stations. You know, we learn a lot over time, right? We learn about the nourishing aspects of hydrating and rehydrating. And so that was not terribly well done. And Gabrielle Anderson, she has even, you know, compounded that because for reasons she can't even explain, she missed the last water station. So she really was only able to take advantage of 4. So you've got all of those things. And then if you guys don't mind me jumping on the David Moorcroft one, because you mentioned it, Dan, he's another chapter of the book. And this guy's a fascinating story because in 1982, you guys, he steps on a track in Oslo, Norway, And he not only sets a 5,000 meter world record, he destroys it. I mean, he takes 14 seconds off the world record, which is unheard of. Had the Olympics been run in 1982, remember my Olympics is a crapshoot comment, that guy's your gold medalist. But in 1984, he's a very injured athlete. He's dealing with severe pelvic injuries. He was a very slight guy. So in 1984, it was all he could do to finish. And so that's not a pleasant memory for him. And yet talked to me and shared his story. And I just love that he did that. And he did it honestly and unabashedly.
I think that's another interesting sort of, I mean, there's some exceptions to this, but for the most part in the Olympics, Olympic sports are very solitary pursuits, both in the event themselves and in the training. You know, you're not yet. Yes, you're going against the other competitors, but you're not running while they're trying to block you. You know, you're racing a lot of times, not even at the same time as them, depending on the sport. You, the only thing that keeps you going is you. You know, you don't have teammates in the sense we think of them in basketball or baseball to pick you up. So it's, you know, these stories of perseverance, while they're all, I don't want to say they're not surprising because individually they're all, you know, inspiring. But when you think about it, it's like to be that determined, to be that good at something that you're basically doing on your own, you have to just be conditioned so differently as a human being.
I think that's right. I think there's something in the DNA of these athletes. And that's what I love about so many of them. You know, if you talk about, for example, we're about to head into Milan Cortina in the Winter Games. If you talk about the losers or the bobsledders, they're training every day. They're getting up at crazy hours of the morning. And there's no big financial pot of gold for these folks, right? This isn't like basketball or football where there's professional leagues and there's millions of dollars possible if you get to be the elite. These people can be the elite, and they're doing it because they love it, and they're doing it because they're determined, and they're doing it because they want to persevere and they want to do the best they damn well can for their country. And that's what almost makes me love, you know, the Olympics and these stories even more. I think your point's a good one, Andrew. And heck, I think that's what makes these athletes more heroic to me.
You've got a couple of sibling stories, and maybe because we're a sibling podcast, those are particularly interesting, because I know that if Andrew had the opportunity to go do a talk show or something based off on our podcast, he would absolutely sacrifice that spot so I could have it, just like the Barnes sisters did for the U.S. in the biathlon. But tell me about the sibling, got two sibling stories in there. Why don't you tell us a little bit about those?
Yeah, they're wonderful stories. Well, the first, you mentioned Tracy Barnes, and she and her sister Lanny are identical twins growing up in Durango, Colorado. That's not Denver. That's the, you know, the western, southwestern corner of Colorado. Beautiful country. Grew up wanting to be the next Mia Hamms, really. They were soccer stars. And then they came up against a wall where they realized that wasn't going to be their path to the Olympics. They learned this in the United States, rather, you know, anonymous sport called biathlon. And in places like Norway, it's massive. But they get to be very good at the biathlon. And they both go to the Olympics in 2006. And then in 2010, for a team of four, Tracy Barnes is in fifth place with one, you know, their multi-day competitions to select the team. And there's one left, and the weather is so foggy and crappy that they call the whole thing off. And Tracy Barnes is sitting one spot outside the Olympic Games in 2010. So bookmark this for what I'm about to say. In 2014... she's skiing out of her mind. I mean, she's doing great. She and her twin sister have always been great at the shooting part of biathlon, the target shooting part. but she's doing really well in the skiing. She's going to be on the team. But she happens to be rooming with her twin sister who's dealing with hacking and coughing and an upper respiratory infection. And her mother tendencies take over, right? She's so devastated by what her sister is going through and really feels like her sister's got as much, if not more, potential as her. And so she comes up with a plan because she's on the team in fourth place. Her sister's one spot outside the team in fifth place. And she decides, yeah, I really love being in the Olympic Games and I would love to go again, but there's someone more deserving than me. And she, first she has to talk to her twin sister into it, whose immediate reaction is hell no. But that, what are you thinking? Then she has to talk her coaches and the head of US Biathlon. Then they have to have it approved by International Biathlon. So Tracy Barnes does something I think unbelievably rare, is that she says, I'm going to take a step back and forfeit my Olympic glory for someone else I think is more deserving. And so that was a fascinating chapter to me on what, you know, what I think of as unparalleled sportsmanship. And then Dan, the other one you asked about, the other siblings featured in the book are William and Charles Flaherty, and they grew up in Cincinnati and in Colorado, but their dad moved them to Puerto Rico. And then their dad had the idea that Puerto Rico, which once upon a time had a winter Olympics team and then had it go away, that they should rekindle that, and that his kids could be on the skiing team. And they train their butts off and they end up skiing for Puerto Rico in the 2018 and 2022 Winter Games, respectively. But that's not the cool part of this story. The cool part of this story is that William, he grows up with this condition known as HLH, and it's somewhat akin to cancer, but he requires constant surgeries and blood transfusions as a little boy, including, you know, a transplant operation where the donor was his older brother, Charles. And so you have William surviving all of this tumult, and you have his brother helping him survive and giving up a liver so that William could live. And then years later, you have both of them competing in the Olympic Games. And, you know, they're both unbelievably great kids. Their dad passed away when they were young. Their mom is, you know, just the can-do, make-it-happen spirit that any of us would want to have as a mom. And so that family overcame so many obstacles for those kids to get to where they got to.
Yeah, and I think the question with the Barnes sisters was sort of whether she would have given up the spot had it been another athlete that she felt was more deserving. And obviously it's impossible to answer that hypothetical, but that story especially kind of speaks to the bond between the two siblings, that one was willing to give up. Now, I guess they both had been to the Olympics at least once previously. So it's not like they were giving up the only slot that they would ever have a chance of, but still right. An incredibly selfless gesture, even if it is for a sibling, really just, you know, a story that I had not been familiar with. It's really just incredible.
Yeah, I think so too. And then the part of the chapter I really loved, I made a point of asking Tracy and several others that very question. I said, well, what if it, instead of it being your twin sister, Lanny Barnes, what if it was just your teammate, Lanny Smith, not related to you, would you have done the same thing? I asked her and I asked Lanny and I asked their dad and I asked their coach, Corey Salmela, and I asked the head of US Biathlon at the time, Max Cobb, independently. And I very purposely did not tell them what the others said, but they all came to the conclusion that Tracy Barnes is the type of person who probably would have done that for someone not her sibling. And I find that fascinating, and I find it really gratifying. And so that to me is a sort of quiet heroism that, you know, isn't going to go down in any history books. I've told people, I think a lot of times the truest heroes are those who don't think they are. And none of the athletes in this book wanted to say, oh, I'm a hero. And that to me makes their actions almost more heroic and genuine.
Can we talk a little about the Peter Norman story? Because that, to me, I mean, it's one of the most famous images in sports, Olympic, American, take your pick history. And he's the other guy in the picture.
He is.
You know, if you don't know much about the story or anything, it's like, well, he's just the white guy standing there while this monumental moment is going on. But I thought you'd do a really good job. So, well, he's a guy who, A, not only is it, you know, the height of his achievements as an Olympian, but there's also a story, you know, a fascinating story about the man himself. So I wonder if you could talk a little about that.
Absolutely. So Peter Norman was a, you know, a remarkably good sprinter for Australia. Almost got to the 1964 Olympics, then did get to the 1968 Olympics. And so to Andrew's point, the 1968 Olympics was an incredibly impactful games because it was only a few years removed from, you know, the major civil rights legislation of our lifetimes, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and Lyndon Baines Johnson. And, so we're only a few years removed from a society where Black people are told they can't go on the front of a bus. They can't drink from the same drinking fountains that white people drink from. They can't attend the same schools. I mean, it's a remarkable time in our history. And also in Australia, you had those prejudices and racial tensions. And so 1968, there's a civil rights activist named Harry Edwards who, you know, went on to a long career at University of California, Berkeley, and he organizes a series of demonstrations. And getting to Andrew's point about the photo, one of them is that two very heralded United States sprinters, Tommy Smith and John Carlos, who were favorites in the 200 meters, are going to do something prolific to stand up for human rights and Black rights. And so what they come up with is that they're going to do a Black Power salute if they get to the medals podium. And so that's the picture that Andrew talks about. You have Tommy Smith, who's in first place doing this. And you have John Carlos, who finished in third place doing this, two African-American sprinters. And in between them is this, you know, this 5'10" white guy named Peter Norman, who nobody had ever heard of. And none of the American team thought was a factor. And yet down the backstretch of the 200, he comes like a freight train. John Carlos makes a mistake of looking back at him, costs him a silver medal. Peter Norman gets that silver medal. But the amazing part of this story to me is that Peter Norman, who, believe me, had his flaws and his faults and his temper, he grew up in a Salvation Army family where he was taught over and over again in the equality of human beings, whatever their race, whatever their religion, whatever their sexual orientation, people are people. So Peter Norman, you know, was let in on what was going to be happening with Tommy Smith and John Carlos. And he said, I'll stand with you. And he didn't just mean I'll stand with you on a medals podium. He said, I am going to be with you and support you. So they were supposed to have gloves on both hands. They were both going to do this on the medal stand. But for whatever reason, four gloves became only two. So he said to Tommy Smith, why don't you do one on your left hand? And he said to John Carlos, you do one on your right. I think it'll still work. That was his idea. He also, you know, took an Olympic, human rights for Olympics button from a U.S. crew team member and said, I want to wear this on the medal stand. And he did. And then over and over again in his lifetime, he appeared at events with Tommy Smith and John Carlos. He really believed in what they were doing. And Andrew, let's dial back to your comments about the solitary pursuits of athletes. And, you know, there was no financial incentive whatsoever for Peter Norman to do what he did. In fact, he got some hate mail and some nasty grams when he got back. And so Peter Norman never advanced his own cause or his own career by standing up for these two gentlemen. But he did it at a time where it was pretty incredible. And you guys, we're sitting here in 2026 and we're still dealing with unbelievable racial tensions, not only in our country, but around the world. And so think about how tough it must have been to take a step out for African-American, Black Americans, Black rights in the 1968 games. And yet he did exactly that. And I found that incredibly heroic for Peter Norman to have done that. And then there's a whole saga that I go into in the chapter. Was Peter Norman almost blacklisted a bit because he did that by his country of Australia? They will tell you absolutely not. But, you know, what happened at the 1972 Olympics? He didn't get in. There's a whole story there. What happened at the 2000 games in Sydney? Did they appropriately recognize Peter Norman as an ex-Olympic medal winner? I think you had a lot of people from the United States saying, not really. You had Australia saying, yeah, we kind of did. But I'm going to give Australia credit. Over time, I think they recognized the magnitude of what Peter Norman had done. And so there was a proclamation that their parliament passed. And there's now a statue in Melbourne near their stadiums that is of Peter Norman in the downtown. So, you know, there's errors of malice and errors of omission. So let's cut the country of Australia a little bit of slack and say, let's call this one an error of omission. And you tried to right it. You tried to right the wrong. Mm-hmm. And I give them a lot of credit for that. But the story in the chapter was fascinating to me because in the United States, we just know next to nothing about this guy, Peter Norman. And yet it's an incredible story.
Yeah, I can't say I knew before this.
I'd be curious, and this is probably not something that would be easy to find out, but I'd be curious if other sprinters in the event were also aware of the possibility of this gesture, because obviously there was no way of predicting that he was going to be the third man on the podium. I mean, obviously maybe he was favored or, you know, because he ended up finishing in second, but I'd be curious whether other sprinters who didn't end up medaling were also aware and had also made plans or expressed an intention about what they were going to do if they ended up on the podium.
Excellent question. The answer is yes. In fact, there was another American sprinter named Larry Questad, and Larry was given a real chance to medal. And Larry was not a big... He wasn't real bought into the whole protest movement for those Olympic Games. He's since passed away, but he was quoted at the time as saying, we didn't even know who this guy Peter Norman was. We certainly didn't think he was going to win a silver medal. So there was actually a belief that the Americans were going to sweep that 200 meters. And if you think back to 1968, you know, Usain Bolt and the whole rise of Jamaica, for example, as a sprinting powerhouse of a country, that hadn't occurred yet. You know, there were sprinters like Bob Hayes, and the Americans were seen as, you know, the top of the ladder for elite sprinters. And so there was a belief that that was going to be a 1-2-3 USA sweep. And we might have had a very different outcome if Larry Questad was on the middle or end step of that podium.
Before we go, there's one more, and I would obviously encourage everybody to check out the book. And check out all the stories, but you know, there's buckets that you, well, first of all, you separate the book into different buckets. You know, you've got those who faced physical adversity at some point, and then there's the siblings, and then there's a few that were, you know, more on the civil rights equality point of view. And the one, and maybe I'm being a little maybe I'm overgeneralizing a little bit here, but the one that I felt like didn't really fit into any of those buckets and maybe was one of them made it maybe to me the most interesting story was this guy, this Lawrence Lemieux, who was a sailing competitor in Korea, in Seoul in 1988. His was really about something very, very different that you probably wouldn't see in a lot of other sports. Maybe tell us a little bit about Lawrence Lemieux.
Yeah, he's definitely a favorite of mine. He was actually the first guy to reply to me and say, hey, yeah, if you want to interview me, that's great. Lawrence Lemieux was someone who got interested in sailing at a very young age. And he was from the province of Alberta. So he's a little bit of an odd stepchild in Canada, because most of their great sailing competitors come from either, you know, their West Coast, think Vancouver and Victoria, British Columbia, or their East Coast, think Ontario. So he was kind of the odd stepchild that way. But this is a guy who got really invested in sailing and began to compete all over North America. And he drove these Econoline vans, you know, and he's taking odd jobs to just afford the ability to enter sailing competitions around North America and driving beat up Econoline vans all over the place. This guy put everything into being an Olympian and wanted so badly to win a medal. And he hadn't done it in prior Olympics. And in 1988, the guy thinks, this is absolutely my time. And he's in the second of several races. Sailing is not just one race. It's several races that add up to a final finish. He's doing extremely well. He's in first place, and then he fades a little bit, and he's in second place. He's doing, you know, he's definitely going to get a second place, and it's probably going to propel him toward a real chance at his first Olympic medal. But something troubling happens, and he sees a head bobbing adjacent to the course that he's on. And he grew up with, you know, this ethos in sailing is that if you see someone in trouble, you help. Now, that's a more difficult proposition when you're in Olympic Games and you're competing like hell against your competitors. But something told Lawrence Lemieux, that guy's in trouble. It was a Singaporean sailor named Joseph Chen, and his teammate was drifting away. And Lawrence Lemieux pulls this guy. He leaves the course of the race he's on. He pulls this guy onto his fin class sailboat, takes him ashore, and he's disqualified himself. So he never did get a medal. But a lot of people will tell you he probably saved Joseph Chen's life. Joseph Chen goes on to become a coach, an important figurehead in Singapore, does a commercial with Lawrence Lemieux years later. And so Lawrence Lemieux didn't get that Olympic medal that he desperately would have loved to have. Very competitive guy. But he probably did something a hell of a lot more important. And, you know, Joseph Chen was, by all his actions, certainly of the belief that he owed his life to Lawrence Lemieux. So to me, it was an unbelievable story. It's been told a little bit, but again, not really one of those things that ever got into the mainstream and got into our memory banks. So it was a story that captivated me for sure.
Yeah, and you get the sense if that happens, you know, now or in the last 15, 20 years, it might be because there'd be so much more video of it that it might, you know, it might be in the zeitgeist a little bit more. But you're right. It's for what it is. And it's, you know, that's something that appeals to people who've never watched a sporting event or sailing in their life. They can connect with that, but you know, for whatever reason, it's not something that, you know, made it into the lasting conscious of the country.
Right.
Well, we touched on some of the stories, others we were not able to get to, but Doug, a really, really interesting and unique book that we really enjoyed reading, and we really enjoyed having you on. The book is Hero Redefined: Profiles of Olympic Athletes Under the Radar, and our guest has been the author, Doug Levy. Thank you very much for joining us, and we really enjoyed it.
Thank you too very much. Enjoyed the Q&A and the dialogue, and wishing you well on all your future podcasts.
Thank you. Well, this will post probably right as the Olympics are getting started, and you'll hope you all enjoy that. I know I'll be watching because my wife insists on it every 2 years. And hope you enjoyed the Olympics, and hope you've enjoyed this episode. We'll be back soon with another sports history episode. But until then, I'm Dan Newman.
I'm Andrew Newman. Goodbye, old sports.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com. Hey there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude. And I hope that you enjoyed this recent episode presented by the Sports History Network and were able to learn some good old-fashioned sports history knowledge nuggets. I started the Sports History Network back in 2020 with the mission to help podcasters find a community of like-minded sports history nerds, as well as helping aspiring podcasters to start their own shows. We have a little bit over 30 shows on the network right now covering all sorts of sports history, but as far as I'm concerned, we're just at the toothpick in the ocean moment, you know, that can't even figure it out because there's so much more coming. We wanted to create the ultimate headquarters for sports yesteryear, starting with Podcast Network and our website, but we're going to continue to move into other mediums as well. And here's the cool part, because we want you to be part of our team. So if you're interested in starting your own podcast, or maybe being a guest on one of our shows, or who knows, maybe even writing an article for us over on the website, seriously, all you got to do is reach out to us on the contact page over at sportshistorynetwork.com. You could be as technologically savvy as a Neanderthal tapping on a stone trying to figure out this whole hieroglyphics thing back in the day. Again, it doesn't matter, because even if you don't understand the whole podcast space, we have a production team that can pretty much help you out with doing everything. All you gotta do, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com, head to the contact page, fill it out. That message goes right to me, and I'll reach out to you as soon as I can. But for now, dude, I'm through if you're through.